Hello, welcome to the National Affairs Podcast. I'm Daniel Weiser.
And I'm Hal Whitman.
And we are editors of National Affairs. National Affairs is a quarterly journal of essays on domestic policy, political economy, society, culture, and political thought. It aims to help Americans think a little more clearly about our public life and rise a little more capably to the challenge of self-government. It's published jointly by National Affairs Incorporated and the American Enterprise Institute.
Today we're very excited to be joined by Dean Ball. Dean is a research fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, where he focuses on artificial intelligence. He also writes a Substack about AI called Hyperdimensional.
For our spring 2024 issue, Dean wrote an essay about the emergence of generative artificial intelligence in the last few years. Many of those who want to regulate AI treat it as an entirely new kind of challenge that calls for entirely new regulatory tools. But starting from scratch is unlikely to lead us to effective regulation. Instead, he writes that regulators should begin from our existing tools and take the time to see what new modes of regulation might be needed. Dean, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start with where you begin your essay, this idea that everyone from academics to journalists, policymakers, even AI researchers and developers themselves say that there's this imperative regulation that is obvious, that we need more regulation of it. But you, at the very beginning, kind of caution against that. You say that even though AI capabilities are expanding quickly, they're not increasing at a rate that would justify an emergency response. And then you have this sentence in the essay where you say, we have more time than many AI regulation proponents would lead us to believe. And so I thought it was an interesting way to start the essay with kind of pushing back on some common wisdom there. And it reminded me of, so Yuval Levin, our editor-in-chief here at National Affairs, he talks a lot about how it's not always good to panic about a policy problem. It's better to worry about it responsibly and not kind of rush to judgments. But yeah, that there's no need to panic. Do you agree with that characterization of AI? Is that where we are with AI? And why do you have confidence that an emergency regulation or regulatory scheme isn't required here?
I'm confident about that because most of the things that people worry about with AI, whether it's disinformation or deepfakes or pandemics or many of these other concerns, are already illegal and already things that our intelligence departments, our defense apparatus, our law enforcement agencies at the local, state, and federal level invest considerable resources, and they're some of the smartest people in our government that are working on those kinds of issues already. And so these are already crimes, and there's already enforcement, and the question of how to modify and scale law enforcement responses to perhaps new threats that could emerge at a greater scale is one that is very serious and something that I work on. But we don't need to pass new, and many of the laws that you are seeing being proposed are essentially just re-illegalizing things. And I just don't know that adds to the epistemic value, our store of knowledge. It's not moving the epistemic ball forward. Mm. And I think that with a technology that does have so many profound unanswered questions, that's really what we need, not just from the corporations and researchers that are working in this field, but it's really what we need from our government too, is to advance our knowledge and give us new capabilities that will allow us to thrive in this era. But that's not knee-jerk regulatory reaction. That's a thoughtful, considered process.
So, Dean, the other thing that would be helpful in this conversation is to define what AI actually is. You write that AI is a, quote, general-purpose technology whose long-term applications are unbounded and hence unknown. So what does that mean exactly? And maybe what are other examples of general-purpose technologies?
It's a great question. A lot of people, when they think of AI, think of language models like ChatGPT.
Right.
ChatGPT has kind of become almost the ambassador for all of artificial intelligence.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. And I think that artificial intelligence more broadly, though, and by the way, language models themselves might be a general purpose technology. Mm. And yet language models are just one subset of this overall field of artificial intelligence. And what it is at its most basic level is the creation of software that can learn about the world dynamically. All human intellectual inquiry, in some sense, is an effort to model the world, to model reality, right? When a child learns how to throw a ball, she's modeling physics. When an economist publishes a dissertation, they're modeling very complex relationships between different economic activity and public policy and you know, many things like that. So modeling is this kind of trying to understand, to pick things apart, complex phenomena, and understand what are the discrete subcomponents and what are the dependencies and relationships here. So in a sense, this is what we've been doing since the dawn of certainly of writing and of language of our species. And AI is a new and very powerful way to do that for things that we have not been able to model successfully in the past. And what's more, it improves at an exponential pace. Just to give it some concrete examples here of what I'm talking about, let's take nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is a technology that has been being worked on for decades. It would profoundly change the economics of energy, of clean energy, and essentially make energy too cheap to meter, basically free.
So that would be like an unlimited source of clean energy.
Yes.
If it was ever feasible.
Yes. Nuclear fusion involves replicating the same process that goes on inside of our sun on Earth in devices that human beings control. There's a design called a tokamak, which is basically you can think of it as a large metal kind of circular object with a donut shape in the middle. And you run plasma at 180 million degrees Fahrenheit through the tokamak at 100,000 miles an hour. And you can imagine that that is a pretty chaotic environment inside of that.
Yeah.
Now, how do you control that? Well, it's very complicated, and there's magnets that you place on the outside to sort of modify the magnetic fields inside of the tokamak so that everything remains stable. But the problem is that you have to continuously fuel the reaction to keep it going. But the reaction, that fuel causes instability. Now, where does AI come into this picture? This is a modeling problem. Modeling that plasma, the state of that plasma, and how to react to changes in this very, very multidimensional environment. It is a problem that computer-based models, previous computer-based models that had the laws of physics explicitly coded into them, could not successfully or reliably do. About a month and a half ago at Princeton University, a group of researchers used a custom-built AI model that is able to control this reaction at almost superhuman capability. Well, any control of this reaction is superhuman because we couldn't possibly do it, but better than our best tools previously.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that that model doesn't have any explicit rules of physics coded into it. There's no formulas or theorems of physics that we have learned over the years coded into it. Instead, it learned itself from reality how to model this very complex and discrete aspect of our world. And so AI will enable countless innovations of that kind, and the cumulative effect of that will be a revolution of science, of technology, and I believe a renaissance if we want it, which is what this article is about.
That's a very interesting example, Dean. I hadn't heard about that, but that's one potential use of AI. It could revolutionize our energy industry, for example.
And many things, too. Protein folding to create new drugs. A new class of antibiotics was discovered a couple of months ago. The first new class in decades using AI. 400,000 new materials were discovered. So the number of materials known to man increased by 10x overnight because of AI.
Wow.
That was in December. So things are proceeding
this
rapidly.
This is just the beginning of...
Yeah, because the hardest part to get one's head around is the exponential aspect of the improvement, because we're just not good at intuiting exponentials. We saw this in the early days of COVID, where it was very hard. People were like, well, there's 100 today. Maybe there'll be 200 tomorrow, and then maybe 400, and then maybe like 600 or like 700, but not like 1,000.
Right.
Yeah. And it's the same thing. Same exact modeling problem. In fact, to make that concrete, in 2022, the federal government unveiled a supercomputer called Frontier, which was the first exascale supercomputer. It's a building in Tennessee. You know, it's like a warehouse. A few weeks ago, Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, released their new B100 top-of-the-line AI chip. These are the chips, everybody, the GPUs, graphics processing units, that everybody talks about. the B100 can, in a single rack, which is a little taller than an adult, average adult male, maybe, you know, 10 feet tall, something like that, that has as much power as that building did. And we will make buildings full of those racks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We will make buildings that have 600 times the power of the most powerful computer in the world 2 years ago, and we will do that in the next year. And then we will do it again and again. And so, yes, the power and is really very, very hard to get one's head around. Mm. And at some point, that's why everybody's focused on energy, and why nuclear fusion is important in a sense, because all of a sudden we have a very compelling new use case for electrons. And so we need a lot more energy.
That requires energy to operate.
Requires a lot. This is going to be very energy intensive. Yes.
I see. Okay, well, that's fascinating, Dean. I want to shift gears a little bit here to talk about regulation, another obviously one of the big topics of your essay. You first note that people in positions of prestige, institutions of government, education, media, seem to be particularly concerned about AI and are calling for regulation. You also know that these are some of the fields that will be very much affected by AI, so that makes sense. But also, kind of later in the essay, you have kind of two camps of people who support regulation, mm-hmm. that you divide into. The first one, you mentioned Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Yeah.
He's very concerned about AI. He's one of these guys that says, one day, if there's a sufficiently capable AI, this AI could clash with humans and destroy all life on Earth. So that's kind of the extreme nuclear option, if you will. Then you have the second camp that is maybe perhaps more concerned about how humans might misuse this technology against themselves. And so from both of these camps, we've seen several different proposals. Everything from a pause or ban on AI research, which would slow some of the development of these things you're talking about. Also, kind of requiring AI companies to register with a government agency. You mentioned this legislation by U.S. Senators Josh Hawley and Richard Blumenthal, that would do this, but also hold AI companies liable for crimes committed with these products. So not just the person who's using this product, the crime, but also the company that created the AI product. What are your thoughts? What are your concerns about these different regulatory proposals that are out there now by these people who think we need more regulation of AI?
The primary concern is that by subjecting software to an FDA or Nuclear Regulatory Commission style centralized bureaucracy, you will, first of all, at the very least, you will shatter the system of so-called permissionless innovation that has permeated the software world. And it's not that permissionless innovation is appropriate for every aspect of the economy, because it's not. We want the FDA to review drugs for safety.
Right.
We want there to be food safety standards. We want to make sure that nuclear fusion reactors, if we build them, are safe. We want all that stuff. It's just that it's really the fundamental problem is it's the wrong level of the technology value chain, so to speak. So the nuclear fusion thing I mentioned, for example, well, AI is being used in thousands of different ways to make the nuclear fusion work. So it's managing that specific part of the reaction I talked about. It's also probably being used to help make the very exotic magnets that have to go on the outside. There's many different parts of this problem. And AI is being used to accelerate or enable new capabilities in all of them. And so it doesn't make sense for every single one of those people, you know, the thousands of different people that are involved in that, to go to some agency and say, can I do this? Can I have an AI system that, you know, makes magnet that helps me find more efficient forms of magnets? It's not useful.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you did create such an agency, I contend that given the general purpose nature of this and mm-hmm. the power that it will have, it would amount to a central planning agency for our economy. And I think there's really no way around that. If you regulate at the model level, that is what you are going to get. And it doesn't matter. People will try to say, well, we'll only regulate above a certain level of so-called FLOPs, floating point operations, which are like basically the amount of computing power that went in to create the model. The exponential I mentioned obviates that, because the Biden administration sets a threshold for, it's not regulation, but reporting at 10 to the 26th flops,
yeah.
which is right now a level that only the top companies in the world can really reach. In 3 years, everyone and their mother is going to be doing 10 to the 26th flops. So it's just not that's not a coherent way to sort of make AI legible to the state.
Mm-hmm.
It can be for some limited purposes, but it's not the basis of a fundamental system of regulation. So it's just it's like regulating metallurgy rather than regulating guns, are regulating missiles. It's like saying, well, I have to make sure that no one's going to use this steel to make a gun or a bullet or something. And it's like, well, that's probably not the most effective way to accomplish that. So, and you probably, like, you know, there's a lot of other uses for steel. So we don't do that. Yeah. We might have standards for steel. There might be, you know, the National Institute for Standards and Technology might say, might have voluntary, you know, this is what defines different alloys or whatever else. And that's something we should probably do, right? Like creating standards, technical standards, very hard to do. We're not in a position to make very useful technical standards right now, but I think we will be in a few years. And so we should be accelerating the scientific research that we need in order to do that. And by the way, that scientific research into the workings of AI systems will also be impeded by regulation, or could also be. So it's just, to put it very simply, not the right level of the chain of production of goods in our economy to be regulating that for almost all use cases, almost all.
So along the lines of what you're saying, you wrote about some of the dangers of using government to, you know, regulate AI broadly, the kind of dangers of that and the way that it's maybe not effective, and noting the example that, you know, there's no Department of Electricity or Department of the Internet, you know, or the kind
Some people want to make the latter.
Yes.
fair enough, yeah.
And, yeah, you say that, you know, that would be what, you know, a similar kind of apparatus for regulating AI would look like, something that you, you know, suggest could lead to significant tyranny. However, you do say that there are some areas where state oversight might actually be helpful, such as reporting requirements for AI data centers and adopting standards for, like, evaluating model performance, reliability, and safety, you say. So how would these work exactly, and to what extent and in what ways would they allay some concerns about AI?
Yeah, so training an AI model has a kind of computational signature that the people that own the servers on which they're being trained can usually detect. So, like, you've maybe heard of Amazon Web Services, which is this network of data centers all over the world that Amazon has built. Microsoft has a similar one, Google, other companies as well. So they're the holders of much of the computing power in the world. And so a lot of the model training that goes on is happening at one of these companies' facilities. And what you want to accomplish is a way of being able to flag potentially dangerous uses of AI,
right?
Potentially suspicious things that sort of, you know, maybe deserve a little bit of extra scrutiny. So in that example, the sort of know your customer for data centers, you wouldn't want to do that for all customers of data centers, probably, because that might make our data centers less competitive, our hyperscalers, as they're called. They might be less competitive internationally. If you did that for every single customer, you know, if I want to create a website, you know, a blog, and I have to do KYC, that, you know, that might not be great. But for very high level, I mean, the UAE, for example, has an open source language model, the country does, that they trained on Amazon Web Services servers, you know, in the United States. Not a problem for me. I don't mind that, but there might be other things that are in that category that are both detectable, at least in theory. And by the way, I think AI can probably help because it's really good at finding subtle patterns. So things that's one category. And then the other is on this technical standards side of things. So the NIST is a very well-respected part of the U.S. federal government. CISA, the cybersecurity agency, is newer, but also quite well-respected. And these are two agencies that a lot of what they do is voluntary. They don't have a lot of mandatory sort of, you know, statutory regulatory authority over companies, but they publish a lot of voluntary standards, best practices, things like that. And NIST standards are actually an enormous form of American soft power. They define technical standards for many of the products in this room and the same products that are, you know, in Japan or France or wherever. It's a way of harmonizing technical standards across the world. And so that is very valuable. You don't want to politicize that process. And you'd one way that you would politicize that process is by making those things mandatory from the get-go, by saying whatever NIST says, you have to do. You're going to mess up NIST. Part of the reason NIST has a good process is that their stuff isn't mandatory. And it's like the companies and academic researchers and all these people come in and sort of help define these standards. To make those standards, you know, these would be like safety standards, reliability standards for models. You've probably seen language models can so-called hallucinate. They can make things up. So, you know, that's a problem that like the industry is definitely aware of and definitely like making improvements on. And so, you know, can we get better at that? Are there best practices? Are there standards for that? Yeah, like for sure there are. And what NIST kind of is in a position to do is survey all of the intellectual inquiry going on things like that and harmonizing and sort of proposing one coherent, clean set of things. And sometimes the law interacts with that. Sometimes laws do point back and say, well, you got to, you know, if you want to commercialize this thing, this model in this way, then you got to be compliant at the least with this standard. So, you know, the FDA can do this too. Medical devices would be a great example. We probably don't want just any AI model going into a medical device that's monitoring some aspect of my body for, you know, a disease or something. We probably want a higher level of reliability than we might want from ChatGPT. Though we want ChatGPT to be really reliable too. But in general, I think that most of these things are things that everybody wants. By you know, you're very much swimming with the current by doing these things, and it's just that there's actual work that has to be done to make all that happen, and so NIST can be an important part of that. But I think that the main view that I have is that it is just like profoundly unhelpful for governments to pass laws that are along the, I mean, in a stylized way, it's illegal for this to go poorly. And it's like, well, yeah, like we all agree about that.
Right.
We don't know what it going well looks like.
Right.
And so, like, we were all wondering about that, too. And now you've just brought, you know, the criminal justice system into the conversation. And that just scares everyone. And like, oh, great. Now there's lawyers in the room. Oh, awesome. Like, not that there shouldn't be lawyers. Obviously.
Right. Right. Should, but that sets a certain tone.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's more like, well, we want this to go well, too. So so what can we do to make that happen? What capabilities can we build? What knowledge can we create? That's the kind of stuff that I think policymakers should be thinking about. So so one thing that I think is just like very important to make clear is that this essay was not meant to articulate a completely hands-off, there's nothing for government to do here vision. Instead, it's meant to say that there's actually a quite energetic role that a competent government can play here, and that I think is actually quite necessary. It's just that it's not most of the proposals that have come out, which is, by the way, totally understandable because most of these proposals were like first drafts and kind of knee-jerk reactions. And that's why we have the system that we have, because it doesn't knee-jerk reactions are hard to do. They're hard to get.
Hard to like pass that in legislation.
It's hard to pass that in legislation. Yeah. That's the whole reason we have the system.
Right.
So right now I'm seeing the system working as designed, but I think it is time, frankly, to just up the general level of inquiry and frankly, the intellectual tenor of this conversation. It's time to grow up a little bit. Like, we should stop talking about these kinds of very far off, is it going to kill us all? Yeah, I can't prove or disprove that claim, and nobody else can either. But there are a lot of other questions between here and godlike AI, if that even is a thing, which I'm not confident it is.
Right.
But there are many questions between here and the sort of 20-year outcome that we need to answer. And so it's time to start asking and answering those more specific questions.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds completely fair, Dean. So yeah, we kind of just have two final questions. It very much dovetails what you're saying about people who still have concerns about AI and how it might be used in the future. First, well, I know you said that you're not saying that there needs to be no regulation of AI. Like, there is a case for an energetic, competent government here to steer things in the right direction, keep it safe and reliable. And I think you write in your essay that we need to strike a balance between hopeful optimism, but also candid recognition of the stark challenges that accompany AI's development. And one thing that people talk about a lot, actually, somebody in our pages have done this before, of talking about how in the Industrial Revolution, people became very concerned about kids were being employed as labor. There was child labor. And so the response was to pass laws regulating that. Some people today have compared that to social media, TikTok, of how it's, people would say, poisoning, you know, a toxic thing for the minds of kids. Therefore, rates of suicidal thoughts, depression, anxiety, all that stuff has gone up. Mm-hmm. This is a case for regulation. Does that debate map onto AI in any way that you see that's relevant? Or is that a different conversation, the type of regulation you're talking about?
I think it's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. I think so. There might be capabilities that AI enables in the long term in the context of AI. So not long term in the context of DC. I'm thinking specifically, I've written quite a bit about neural interfaces, brain-computer interfaces. You know, the brain is something that can be modeled mathematically as well. And we're making
What we can understand about it anyway. I know the brain's a complex thing.
Many aspects of thought can be understood now. Mind reading using AI, it's in limited ways, is now possible. And so, you know, that's an area of research that I'm very intrigued by. And I don't quite know, you know, where it's going to go. And I'm not rah-rah about it. But I also think it's quite interesting. I can see that being the kind of thing that we want to be pretty circumspect about putting, you know, kids being involved. And by the way, I'm not talking about like the Elon Musk chip in the brain thing. I'm talking about devices that you wear outside the head with no invasive procedures.
I see. So, two different things there.
Still, even then, I think, you know, there are some considerations there.
Sure.
But frankly, if I had a child, I would want them using the smartest chatbot. The thing is, not the only thing I'd want them doing, but I would want them to engage with it, and because I think they're wonderful. I mean, chatbots tutor me.
For educational purposes.
They're wonderful tutors. So I worry about that. And frankly, I you know, when it comes to the kids' online safety stuff, I have very nuanced opinions about that subject. As a kid who grew up in large part like on the internet, you know, like I went to a small middle school. I didn't have a lot of friends who shared my quirky interests. And so it was great to have the internet as a place where, you know, I could kind of live and make friends. I have friends that I made 20 years ago on the internet when I was 11 that are still my friends. Mm-hmm. So I also realize the internet's changed a lot and the devices through which we consume it have changed a lot. So it's like, you know, I'll just say I'm really glad it's not my issue area. I just to like expand on it slightly more.
Yeah.
It does get it, the digital, the kids online safety stuff. It does get at one thing that I think is a good example of what I'm talking about with in terms of building capabilities. Part of the reason, you know, a lot of the people who are on the other side of it that don't like the Kids Online Safety Act will say, well, it's a privacy nightmare because you have to validate the IDs of, you know, I don't know whether or not that's actually true, but it certainly is true in some cases. Like, you actually do have to, like, collect the kids' and the parents' IDs, and it's like, well, okay, wait, I thought we didn't like these companies collecting data, now we're mandating it.
Right.
Part of the reason that that's such a quagmire is because we lack the ability to validate people's identification on the internet in a robust, secure, provable way. I have no way of saying to you, like, I know for 100% sure that this is Dean emailing me. There's no way to do that. And it's a very hard technical problem. At the same time, in the physical world, the government is our source of ID. And so I think that that's something worth exploring. I don't know that it's something the government should actually be doing. This is called digital public infrastructure. Other countries, Estonia, India, I mean, India has this for more than a billion people. So it's not that it's not doable.
Yeah.
I think we could even do it better than them. I think we could do it in an outstanding way that is also secure, that doesn't allow for government surveillance.
Right.
And I'm doing some work on this right now. Now, again, I don't know if it actually is desirable to do in the final analysis, but that is the kind of thing, adding new capabilities rather than simply legislating from the top down safety and whatever else.
Right.
One of those things is better than the other, in my view.
For a last question, following up on neural technology.
We became fascinated with this, reading a little about it.
Yeah. In one of your recent posts in your Substack, you mentioned this neural technology and the potential for inducing different conscious states, mm-hmm. like happiness or reflectiveness or focus. And as a result of these technologies, you predict that, quote, the line between man and technology will continue to blur in the coming years. So I think for a lot of people, you know, really religious believers in particular, this raises some really profound concerns about, you know, integrating man and machines in the ways that this could undermine human dignity and an idea of human nature mm-hmm. as created by in the image of God. And, you know, there are more secular versions of that concern. So no matter how much AI is, you know, wisely regulated, is that kind of alteration of human nature inevitable? I know that's a massive question, but I guess more specifically, how do you respond to some, those who continue to harbor really grave concerns about where this could lead, no matter the economic and health and other benefits of AI?
For sure. No, absolutely. And I wrote that article, the primer on neural technologies, not as a, you know, this is great and I'm excited for it. More as a, I you know, there's a friend of mine who calls himself an AI scout. And I consider myself like a neural technology scout. Like I'm just trying to go out there, and there's this very diverse literature. So the technology that you're referring to is called transcranial focused ultrasound. And what it involves is putting, basically firing very, very high frequency sound waves into the head, like into the brain, targeted at specific areas. The FDA says this is safe. I mean, this is not like, this is something that's been tested quite a bit. It's been around for a long time as a technology. And it can induce, I would say, pretty low dimensional coarse conscious experiences at this point. So it can make you more focused. It can improve mood, at least in laboratory settings it can. Hmm. It can be used to do all sorts of things like that. It's been used to help people with that are recovering from various kinds of cognitive, you know, injuries, other sorts of things, restoring movement. You can simulate the sensation of touch using it. You can change aspects of the visual field. So like if you shut your eyes and put your fingers on your eyelids lightly, those like blobs you see, mm-hmm. those are called phosphenes. You can induce those in someone with their eyes open. Mm. Which can actually be useful, like for stimulating the visual field for people that have had that capability impaired.
Sure.
So there's all kinds of medical applications, right. But yeah, I think this is the kind of thing where some people are going to draw a hard line, and everyone's going to draw different lines. And I think that the function of the state in this regard is to ensure that people have a choice. To ensure that seems to me to be the main thing. I can't imagine a world in which if some people wanted to do this, that we would not let them. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine a world where I'd support. I can definitely imagine that happening, I can't imagine that being supportive of that. At the same time, you know, if it really caught on and all the kids were using it to make themselves more productive or something like that, you know, that would require maybe some more complex focus, mm-hmm. because I just don't, you know, I think it's too early to be worried about that, okay. per se, because it, you know, this is pretty far off and we right. don't know what the extent of
it's
it
more of a medium long term
yeah.
issue.
There's a device that will ship that might have these capabilities in the next year.
Okay,
so keep an eye out for this stuff, but I would say don't be too alarmed yet. I think also that, you know, there are areas where like technical standards can be used here too. The FDA could say, for instance, well, this device will actually only, you can only use it so many times in a day to induce this particular, you can't make yourself very happy. You know, you can't make yourself feel ecstatic all day long. Uh-huh. But maybe you can, you know, you can enhance your focus if you want to, whenever you want. You know, things like that. There's definitely room there. I think it's a bold new frontier, and possibly the reason I like to write about it is because I think that it could be the source of some of the most certainly vivid experiences with technology and uses of technology that people see in the coming years. So we will see. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fascinating, Dean. Well, I think, you know, if nothing else, I think, as you said, Dean, this conversation a lot of times lacks a lot of nuance. We kind of go to extremes and extreme claims. And I think you really provided a lot of nuance and a lot of thoughtfulness about how to think about this problem, not only now, but in the future. So we really appreciate you writing the essay for us and coming on the show to talk about it.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it.
If you'd like to read Dean's essay or other articles in National Affairs, please visit our website at nationalaffairs.com and consider subscribing. In addition to a printed copy of National Affairs, subscribers retain unlimited access to our online archives. And you can find more episodes of our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe and leave a review. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at National Affairs. Thanks for listening.